right, everybody. Everybody, every hero's got to have his own theme music. And my guest today is certainly that. And that's why he gets his own hero theme music here. It's the other Scott Horton. No relation whatsoever. If there is some, it goes back a thousand years or something. So please don't hold him responsible for my antics. He's a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine. He's an international human rights lawyer and expert in the laws of war. He's the co-founder of the American University of Central Asia in Bishkek, Kyrgyzstan. He's a former chairman of the New York Bar Association's Committee on International Law. He sits on the board of the National Institute of Military Justice, the Andrei Sakharov Foundation, the Eurasia Group, and the American branch of the International Law Association. He writes one of the best blogs on the entire World Wide Web. It's called No Comment at harpers.org. Welcome back to the show, Scott.
Why, thank you. It's great to be here. It's great to have theme music, too. I always wanted to be identified with a gangster.
Yeah, there you go. Well, no, KRS-One's not a gangster. See, that's I don't know if you ever saw I'm Gonna Get You, Sucka, about the gold chain war.
Not yet.
Oh, okay. Well, it's kind of a Keenan Ivory Wayans blaxploitation flick, and every hero's got to have theme music that follows them around playing, and so this is the hero's theme music there. So that's for you, because you are, as far as I can tell, the most adamant and effective opponent of this government's use of torture in the entire country.
Well, I wish I were more effective, because I don't think we've succeeded in bringing it to an end yet.
Well, I suppose that's right, but I don't think there's anybody who's done more than you to try to make it so, at least. And in fact, I'd like to start, you know, obviously we got to talk about Alberto Gonzalez here, but I'd really like to start with this July 20th executive order that George Bush signed. And I understand from breezing through this thing quickly before the show and from checking out what you wrote about it on the No Comment blog at Harper's Magazine that the military basically is instructed by this executive order to abide by the law and their interrogation handbook and so forth, but the CIA is not. They're given much more leeway to torture people, and this has the military concerned. Is that right?
That's exactly right.
And so why would the military care who the CIA tortures?
Well, I'd say, you know, there are a number of different reasons for this. I mean, one is that this is setting a new standard that can be used on personnel in future conflicts. And, of course, they're concerned about these techniques being applied against American personnel, military and also non-military personnel in future conflicts. But then there are two other specific reasons. I mean, one of them is that the CIA isn't in the business of running prisons, doesn't want to run prisons. Most of these prisoners are going to be held in prisons that are operated by the military. And the military bears responsibility for what happens to them in the prisons and has responsibility for their oversight. So this is a direct conflict. If you allow the CIA to use these techniques, it's going to go into Guantanamo, Bagram, and other facilities that are operated by the Department of Defense and start using them. And then that's going to violate the DOD's own guidelines.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an area of big concern. And then the other thing is, well, of course, we know many of these techniques were used at Abu Ghraib, and we know that the CIA and civilian contractors came in and used them. And the Department of the Army's report about this, the one that was done by Faye Jones and General Kerr, said that this contributed to deterioration of morale and discipline at the prison in Abu Ghraib. So I think there's a lot of concern about that happening, too.
Mm-hmm.
So it undermines traditional military discipline and norms.
And now you even quote in your article, you talk about the Japanese war crimes trials at the end of World War II, and that some of the Japanese military commanders said, hey, look, torture happened at our military base, but it was civilian intelligence agencies that came and did it. It's not our fault. And that they were hung from the neck. That wasn't a good enough excuse.
That's correct. And the same thing happened also with the Nuremberg cases, because German military officers said, you know, we weren't the ones who were doing the torture. That was the SD and other organizations who did it. And the view of the American judges there, as well as the other international judges, was not good enough. Sorry. It's a rule of absolute responsibility. So that's a rule that was advanced by the United States. So, you know, we need to plan with that in mind.
And now you also wrote that the American Bar Association has gone to Congress and asked them to overturn this executive order. How unprecedented is that?
First time, as far as I know, that anything like this has ever happened. This was a major subject of discussion at the ABA conference out in San Francisco. The ABA concluded, in fact, there was a vote of 545-1, that the executive order itself was unlawful, and they committed to get it overturned by Congress.
Okay, now, this is the tough one. If I remember right, and hey, you're the lawyer on the local radio show host here, my best understanding, last summer, the Supreme Court ruled you can't do this unless Congress says it's okay. And then Congress said it's okay and passed the Military Commissions Act that legalized the detention even of Americans as enemy combatants and gives the president the authority to decide what's torture and what's not torture. So in what way is this executive order illegal? He cites the Military Commissions Act right in the opening paragraph here, Scott.
That you got it right all the way up to the end. The Congress required him, because Congress was concerned about the way he was going to exercise his discretion. So Congress said, we're not going to allow you to do that quietly. You have to put it in a written order that's issued and is published. And that then created the basis for Congress to overturn it if they were unhappy with it. And Congress also said that this order has to be consistent with Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions, which it isn't. I mean, that was the basis for the decision at the ABA. It's not consistent with Common Article 3.
Right. In fact, let me play this very short clip of George Bush complaining about Common Article 3 here.
And that Common Article 3 says that, you know, there will be no outrages upon human dignity. It's very vague.
and we can see that's why he doesn't like it, because it's vague. And he wants specific ways that he can violate human dignity. And then, you know, if you want to set aside other ways that he's not allowed to, then that's okay, too, I guess.
Well, I think his complaint is not that it's vague. His complaint is that it's very clear, because Common Article 3 does not permit waterboarding, long time standing, use of heavy stress techniques, sleep deprivation over 2 days, for instance. All those things are clearly precluded, and President Bush has authorized them. So that's the conflict is between George W. Bush and the Geneva Conventions, which is to say it's really between George W. Bush and Abraham Lincoln, Dwight David Eisenhower, and others who were responsible for setting the prior standards.
Mm-hmm. And both of those presidents did use military commissions and so forth. How different is the current system from what, say, Ike did?
Well, I don't think that there's really anything the matter with military commissions per se as a category. And in fact, military commissions, there's a long history of using them. They were used very, very heavily during the Civil War, for instance. I mean, there are a lot of people who know their Civil War history from the South know about how oppressive these things were viewed by Southerners. But, you know, what's going on is the procedures that are used by the commissions is the issue. And I think, the thought amongst the lawyers and a lot of others who've looked at this is that if you use regular court-martial procedures, the standing rules that have been used, by our military since, you know, roughly the end of World War II, with a lot of tweaks and changes, that's fine. That's not going to raise any issues. But, you know, what the Bush administration has tried to do is craft its own entirely new rules for use with these detainees, and the new rules that it's crafted are not up to snuff. They're absolutely not acceptable. And, you know, we saw what happened with the two proceedings that went forward in Guantanamo. Two different judges, a colonel and a Navy captain, both said, this is, you know, doesn't work. We have to dismiss the cases. You know, they don't meet minimum standards. And then we also had the Combat Status Review Tribunal there, and, you know, Colonel Abramson, you know, from California, who was one of the officers responsible for one of them, made public statements and announced what was going on there, and he said it was a complete farce. That there really was no justice or any probing going on here. Decisions were predetermined and were sent to them. So it's not a justice system at all, and, you know, not the sort of thing that our founding fathers would have ever approved or that Congress authorized.
Right. In fact, there's even been some cases, right, where the original three officers found that there was no evidence that this or that guy had any ties to Al-Qaeda, et cetera, and they just basically did the whole thing again and again until they found three officers who were willing to say, yeah, he's guilty as hell.
That's exactly right. We had a lot of people with respect to whom there really was no evidence against them, and they just kept going back 2, 3, 4 shots at the apple until finally they got a panel that would give them the result they wanted.
Well, what they ought to do is just tie a stone around their neck and throw them in the lake, and then that way, if they sink, they'll go to Christ, and if they can swim, then that means they're a witch, and then we can take care of them, you know. They'll have to report back here for hanging or burning later.
Well, this has been an express train back to the 8th century. I think you're right on that.
It really does seem that way, doesn't it? I mean, what, the Magna Carta was, what, 1215 AD?
That's right.
That's a long time ago. That's a lot of tradition of protection from double jeopardy and so forth to be flushed down the toilet.
And habeas corpus, not to be forgotten, because that was the one of the major innovations brought in with Magna Carta.
Mm-hmm. And now when you talk about this whole new legal structure that's been set up to justify all this, last summer the Supreme Court basically found, although clearly they didn't say it this way, but basically what they said was, no, you're a felon. What you've been doing this entire time is illegal, and you have to get Congress to legalize it, or you may not continue doing it.
That's right, because everything the administration had done had been predicated on the idea that Common Article 3 didn't apply and they didn't have to obey it, and the Supreme Court said, wrong, wrong. It does apply, and you do have to obey it. And that means all these techniques and procedures that had been used didn't comply with Common Article 3. And something that doesn't comply with Common Article 3 is a war crime, actually. It's a felony under U.S. statute. So, you know, what had been done there was raised very, very serious criminal law issues.
Right. And here's where we get to the Attorney General, who announced his resignation yesterday. He's the guy. It's his signature on the paperwork, right, that says that the Geneva Convention is quaint and does not apply to our current situation.
Not only that, but in that same memorandum, he talks about the prospect that the authors of this new system, which is to say himself and Mr. Cheney in particular, may be prosecuted in the future by U.S. attorneys and other prosecutors for what they've done. And he spends a lot of time trying to figure out how will we avoid criminal law liability for what we're doing. And in this case, with the military commissions, Alberto Gonzalez crafted these rules. He put them forward. He didn't even consult with the senior military officers who are normally responsible for making them. They had to go to Congress and complain about it. In fact, they went to Congress and they opposed what Alberto Gonzalez did. I don't think in American history anything like that ever happened before.
Right. And in fact, that's how you got involved in this yourself, right? Was that the judge advocate generals, the JAGs, they came to you and said, help, because all this is going on under what's supposed to be our control, and yet we're frozen out of the process. We're going to get the blame for this.
That was back in 2003. They were trying, of course, not just to get my personal involvement, but to get the Bar Association in, and I was chairing a committee at that time. And we did, in fact. You know, I think the Bar Association has been lined up behind the professional military lawyers from the beginning on this matter.
Yeah, I'm talking with American hero, the other Scott Horton from Harper's Magazine here. And doesn't it seem strange, all these things that about, you know, Geneva being quaint and, boy, I sure hope we're not hung for war crimes later and so forth. All this was known before Alberto Gonzalez was ever confirmed to be the Attorney General of the United States, wasn't it?
Yes, I think it was. And, you know, it figured very heavily in the confirmation hearings for him. He was hit with a lot of questions and gave a lot of embarrassing and evasive answers.
Yeah, I mean, you call him a crony in your blog entry on No Comment blog at harpers.org.
I was quoting Britt Hume at Fox News, by the way.
Right, and wasn't that surprising to see him saying that, huh?
Well, I think, frankly, it's what all the newscasters in Washington have been saying, regardless of their political views, for some time. Everybody's looked at Gonzalez and said, this man is, you know, nothing more, really, than a political hack. Of course, they don't say that on their broadcast, but, you know, Britt Hume came out and said it publicly yesterday, so.
Right. And it's always been obvious, just, you know, to the average guy tuning in, that this guy Gonzalez is nothing but, you know, a personal friend and flunky of Bush and Rove.
I think that's right. And, you know, the right thing would be to have an attorney, as an attorney general, somebody who stands on his own legs, who's independent, who has stature, who's respected in the community, all things that weren't true with respect to Alberto Gonzalez. And I, you know, we're in a position right now that's a lot like what happened with the Justice Department in the months right after the Watergate scandal reached its peak and Richard Nixon resigned. Remember, Gerald Ford came in then, and one of the first things he had to do was to replace the Attorney General. We'd had two Attorney Generals who were then under criminal investigations. That's another thing I think we're likely to see repeat. And, you know, he spent a lot of time thinking over who he was going to appoint, and he appointed Edward Levy. And Levy was the president of the University of Chicago, very conservative Republican, but he was a figure who was very far away from partisan politics and was respected by everybody. I mean, it was a brilliant choice and went a long way towards restoring the reputation of the Department of Justice.
Right, and that really is kind of, at least, the tradition in America. Not that we've always lived up to it perfectly, but I think the American people pretty much expect that the head of the EPA or the head of the Commerce Department or something like that is going to be a political crony, and what are you going to do? It's Andrew Jackson's system, right? But on the other hand, the Attorney General of the United States, he's supposed to be a serious lawyer. He's not supposed to just be the flunky of the president. I mean, we have a tradition of that, right?
That's exactly right. In fact, Elihu Root, who's very, very famous Republican Secretary of State, also former president of the Bar Association, said that half of the task of a really good lawyer is telling his client that he's a damn fool and he needs to respect the law. And, you know, that's exactly what Alberto Gonzalez was not. He would never stand up to people who sought advice from him and tell them that they were contemplating something was wrong and they needed to respect the law. And what we really badly need is an attorney general who will adhere to that idea.
Well, we have a real problem, don't we, that he's been forced to resign basically over this U.S. attorney scandal, which, you know, hey, felonies are felonies and everything, but here's a man who was confirmed after passing, you know, these legal judgments that it's okay to torture people up to the point of organ failure, or even then if it's militarily necessary. And, you know, I think it was the Bybee memo that says, hey, even if you kill them, we know that you meant well and that you were trying to prevent a greater harm. He got confirmed after all that, and now he's being run out for the attorney scandal. Doesn't it seem, it's like Clinton burning Waco and then getting impeached for Monica Lewinsky.
I wouldn't underestimate the importance of the U.S. attorney scandal, because what's at the bottom there is politicizing the Department of Justice and using prosecutors for partisan political purposes. And that's something that's not new in the history of the American Republic. It's happened, in fact, a lot in the history of the American Republic. But it is a particularly serious problem when it happens. And, you know, if we look back to what's happened since 2002, roughly, we've got a lot of really suspicious political prosecutions that occurred. I mean, look at the case of, you know, Governor Don Siegelman in Alabama. You know, that's being exposed now as an egregious political prosecution that involved Karl Rove from the beginning. He was convicted and he's sitting in a prison in Texas right now. You know, I certainly expect that's going to wind up being overturned, but that's one of the cases that really badly needs to be explored right now by a special prosecutor and by Congress.
Yeah, and that's something that you've actually covered in great detail on your blog, No Comment, at Harper's Magazine.
That's right. I mean, we had a young Republican attorney in Alabama come out and disclose after Siegelman was convicted. She said, you know, this is a miscarriage of justice, and I can't keep quiet about this anymore. I have to come forward and announce what happened. And she described some of the conversations in which Karl Rove is mentioned and his involvement and his interventions and manipulation of the case come out. And, of course, we know that Karl Rove and Alberto Gonzalez were very, very close. In fact, New York Times this morning is reporting that in the White House, Alberto Gonzalez didn't have a lot of friends, and it was really Karl Rove who was standing up for him and also giving him directions about everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what Sidney Blumenthal has written on Salon.com, that once Rove was gone, Gonzalez was sure to follow soon because he was the puppet, and nobody working his strings means he collapses, basically, I guess was the analogy he made.
I think that's right. And, of course, the big struggle now, the showdown between Congress and the Bush administration, is over a bunch of emails and other documents. And what's the key there? It is Karl Rove's relationship with the Department of Justice. I think these documents are going to show that Rove was pulling the strings and what was happening across the department. And that would be shocking. In fact, it would be a crime. And the Bush administration's gone to a scorched earth policy to avoid having those emails become public.
Now, they quickly leaked the name after it was announced that Gonzalez was leaving of Michael Chertoff, the current secretary of the, and I'm going to need your help with the German here, it's the Heimatsicherheitendienst.
Yeah, Staatssicherheitsdienst, they would call it. You know, Stasi, they call it in East Germany. If you translate that into English, you get Department of Homeland Security.
Uh-huh. Wow. And so now he's been floated. The trial balloons are out that he would be the replacement. And I can't remember if this was a conversation I had with you or whether it was with Jim Bovard or what, but somebody intelligent on this show was talking about how they're going to try to keep Gonzalez as long as they possibly can, because how hard is it going to be to find a replacement who's not going to immediately uncover everything his predecessor did in order to protect himself? And I guess bringing Chertoff in is the answer to that riddle, huh?
I think it's that is the dilemma. And, of course, Michael Chertoff previously was at the Department of Justice. He headed the criminal division, and he's been an integral part, even when he left and went to DHS, he's been an integral part of all of these plans for, let's say, special law of our war on terror law, including these extraordinary detention regimes. He's linked all the way back to the beginning to the torture and torture process. In fact, when he was nominated for Department of Homeland Security, he testified denying any involvement. And subsequently, you know, a lot of information's come out just showed that he wasn't being candid with the Judiciary Committee, because he now, you know, we know that he was involved in reviewing the original torture memorandum, the one that John Yoo and Jay Bybee wrote. And we also know he was approached by the CIA at an early point with his assistant, Alice Fisher, who now heads the criminal division, and they were asked to give assurance that if CIA agents and others used these techniques, they weren't going to be prosecuted for crimes. They were pushed for that because pretty much all the lawyers who looked at it thought these are criminal acts and they could be prosecuted. So we want the head of the criminal division to say that won't happen. Now, he's insisted that he never gave that assurance, but I've heard from a number of sources that indeed he did. And in any event, we've got a lot of documentation that subsequently come out showing his involvement in this process, the solicitation of advice from him, also that he was briefed and members of his staff were briefed by FBI agents who were down at Guantanamo about the highly abusive techniques that were used. So it's quite clear that Chertoff knew about all these procedures and absolutely approved them.
Well, so then that makes him a perjurer, right?
I think that's right. In fact, if you look, Mark Benjamin at Salon.com this morning has got a big article about it in which he focuses on some of the specific statements that Chertoff made, and he says, you know, why is this not perjury? And I would say, you know, Michael Chertoff has got a lot of explaining to do. And it's not just that, too. You know, we also have the incident involving John Walker Lind and statements he made about Jesselyn Raddick, who was an ethics officer at the Department of Justice, who rendered an opinion. He made a whole series of completely false statements about that. I mean, whatever opinion you may have about the issues in the John Walker Lind case, so let's just put that to a side. He simply made false statements about what went on within the department and his involvement in it, and I think he was trapped in those misstatements too. So there's quite a bit there. And by the way, this is not even getting into Hurricane Katrina, and you know, he was the man in charge.
Right, absolutely. And now, and you say on your blog too that I guess it's been reported, but they haven't surfaced yet, that there are two actual memos with his signature on them in regards to the torture policy?
Yes, I've been told that there are further documents that have not surfaced that were crafted by him and by Alice Fisher that relate to this approval of specific techniques. So that was basically giving assurance that there would be no prosecutions brought if these techniques were used. And that included waterboarding, for instance, long-time standing, hypothermia, stress positions, things of that sort.
And you also wrote, I think, on the no comment blog there at harpers.org that visit to Attorney General Ashcroft in his hospital bed had something to do with this assurance that the CIA was seeking that they wouldn't be prosecuted. Is that right?
Well, I think that's a little bit different. That really relates to the telecommunications industry.
Oh, right, right. I'm sorry.
Right?
Yeah, I'm mixing up my apples and oranges here.
But let's get all that out, because I think that's extremely interesting. The telecommunications industry have been asked to allow physical devices to be installed in some of their switches that would allow U.S. intelligence agencies to monitor traffic, telephone calls, emails, internet access, and things of that sort. And I think as their general counsel looked at it, they said, well, you know, what you're asking us to do is illegal, because the FISA Act says you got to have warrants for these things, and you haven't given us any warrants. And I think the general counsel went back and said, look, we at least want you to get the attorney general's signature on an opinion or document telling us that this is okay, that this is authorized, because the FISA Act does have provisions in it that give the attorney general this extraordinary interim authority to approve things. And he also is the officer who gives legal opinions on behalf of the government. So they were saying, look, you bring us a piece of paper that the attorney general has signed, and we'll go ahead with it, but not without that. And that's the reason for this rush to the hospital bed of John Ashcroft to get his signature on the document. And let's just stop and think about this for a moment. John Ashcroft was sedated under tremendous pain, and he had turned over the responsibilities of Attorney General to James Comey. So they were trying to get him to sign a document, you know, holding himself out as Attorney General when he was not and was not exercising the authority of the Attorney General. So if they were going to do that and use it with the phone companies, they were doing something unethical.
Well, and they've said now that it's all state secrets, that if Scott Horton wants to, you know, have a client, wants to file a lawsuit on behalf of a client who thinks he's been wiretapped or what have you, you can't take them to court over this because state secrets would be revealed in the trial. So if the administration has their way, the Supreme Court would not be able to review whether this new bill just passed and signed by the president, basically legalizing all this stuff, is unconstitutional or not.
I think that's right. I mean, let's just go back and use the circumstances when they invoke state secrecy. The most common circumstance we're seeing all the time is when they commit a crime. So they're wiretapping people, they're engaged in surveillance without a warrant. That's a felony. And they don't want the fact of their criminal conduct disclosed. Or they're torturing people, as in Guantanamo. Because the transcripts that come out of Guantanamo are all redacted. When they ask people, you did something to, something was done to you that you think is torture, describe what was done. All redacted, okay? Because they don't want to provide evidence of criminal conduct. And then the other instance in which we see it being used is when it would be politically embarrassing to the White House or the political leadership of the country. Now, those are completely improper uses of state secrecy, but those are about the only uses that the only circumstances in which it invokes a state secrecy. And then let's go back and look at this case involving FISA surveillance. You know, they told a court, the Ninth Circuit and a federal court in California, that all this stuff was highly secret. No information could be given out about it. And then Mike McConnell gives an interview with the El Paso Times down in Texas, in which he, you know, over four pages, lays it all out in tremendous detail.
That's the National Intelligence Director.
That's exactly right. So, you know, it's secret in that we don't want you, court, to know about it, but if we think it advances our political case in some way, we'll set it out in all detail. Nothing is a secret. So it's, you know, completely, astonishing use of the state secrets document. And I think this is the reason why we see judges all across the country raising eyebrows and expressing extreme skepticism when they invoke this. And I'd say that's entirely appropriate.
Well, and it's the courts that made up the state secrets privilege in the first place, so they can ignore that point of view being put forward by the executive branch if they want, right?
I think that's right. It was judicially created, and it needs now to be judicially confined. I think it was designed for extreme circumstances, and the problem is now that the Bush administration uses it at the drop of the hat all the time. Whenever they think something's about to embarrass them, they pull out their penalty marker and throw it down and say this game is over. Mm-hmm. And you, court, are not even allowed to look at things. And I think they've been doing this now for 4 years, and I think the courts are just about up to here with it.
I have to admit, I'd never even heard of the state secrets privilege until the Bush administration. I thought that was it was kind of on my list of the things that make our legal system different from the one in Great Britain, is they have this Official Secrets Act, and we don't. We're a free country with a constitution and a Bill of Rights.
Exactly correct. I mean, if you go back and you check on Google for state secrets, you're going to find it's being used in Britain all the time, and it belongs to the legal regime of Great Britain. And in the United States, it's something that's extremely rare, almost unheard of. But, of course, what Bush and Alberto Gonzalez have been trying to do really for, you know, 4 or 5 years now, is introduce the British State Secrets Act system. And, of course, that's something that works just fine. It's for a country that doesn't have a tradition of constitutionally protected free speech that we have.
Scott Horton, international human rights lawyer, no comment blog at Harper's Magazine. Can I keep you for another 10, 15 minutes here?
Absolutely.
Okay, great. I want to talk about Iran. You wrote a blog entry on your no comment blog recently, which we actually ran in the viewpoint section at antiwar.com, I think, yesterday, and maybe the day before. And you list quite a few reasons to believe that we are headed toward a strike against Iran within perhaps the next 6 months or a little more than that. And I kind of wondered whether, you know, we can tie this all together with what's going on with this situation in Iraq. You characterized Bush's speech at the Veterans of Foreign Wars as his Weimar speech, the stabbed in the back speech. Everything's going great except for the people who are against the war are going to ruin everything for us. And, of course, the Vietnam analogy and all that. And we've seen a lot of talk recently about and as you've noted also on No Comment about Maliki being replaced perhaps with Iyad Alawi. And I just wonder if we can kind of discuss this in the context of what Seymour Hersh calls the redirection, the stab in the back of the Shia that America has installed and protected in power all these years in Iraq and moving back toward our Sunni Arab allies in an effort to contain the influence of Iran. I guess if we can start with this Weimar speech here, this VFW speech, the stab in the back. You compared this to the German propaganda after World War I, that this is the only reason we lost is because the civilian leadership stabbed our heroic soldiers in the back.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's especially associated with Eric Ludendorff, you know, who was one of the major military leaders during World War I. And it's completely untrue because, of course, Germany at the end of World War I was just a military dictatorship, and Ludendorff and Hindenburg were running the country together with the Kaiser. The, you know, political leadership had been basically thrust into a corner and silenced. And so they lost that war completely on their own with all the resources of the state behind them. But I think they realized after the war that there really was no more effective tool you could use to silence your political adversaries than this. Because if they say anything back, you'll say, you're disparaging the soldiers, you're disparaging the military. And, you know, in Germany, of course, the military was a sacrosanct institution. And since that time, idea of stab in the back has been viewed as politically one of the most powerful propaganda tools or weapons that can be wielded. And William Kristol is one of the people who's written and talked about this, in fact, and he's advocated using it. And lo and behold, he uses it in articles in the Weekly Standard. Now we're seeing it as a centerpiece of Bush's speeches, the American Legion and VFW speeches, for instance. But, you know, we ought to come back and talk specifically about the issues in Iraq and Iran right now. And I think, there really is, a very serious prospect of a new war being started against Iran right now. And Iran, of course, is a nation of 70 million. It's a, much more formidable power than Iraq is. But, what's driving us towards this? You know, there seems to be a sense within the White House that Iran is developing nuclear weapons, which I think is correct, and is developing delivery systems, which is probably true, but they're probably sometime back. There's also a recognition that this is not something that's really imminent, but there is a real clock on the amount of time that Bush has got left in office. And Cheney and many of his people feel that this is the last administration for a while that'll be able to take decisive action, so it'll be us or no one. So they're really pushing and pressing for this military action.
Mm-hmm. I'm kind of surprised to hear you say you think they are working on a bomb. I saw George Bush just 2 weeks ago, I guess one day he said, they've openly declared they're going to make a nuclear bomb, and then a day or two later, he came out and said, well, the fear is that if they continue working on the uranium enrichment program they have now, that could lead to them beginning to create a nuclear weapons program, basically admitting that they don't have one.
No, I think that's exactly right. It's not that they have one, but that they aspire to have one, that's a different question. And I think as it stands right now, let's assume that this program that they have running continues to accelerate a good bit. We're probably talking about, 18 to 20 months before there's enough to enrich uranium for a bomb. Okay, but that's one bomb, mind you. And then you have the whole delivery system issue. And, if you're really going to be anything like a nuclear power, you certainly need a lot more than one bomb. So practically speaking, we're talking about several years. So it's, so we're talking about this threat arising on the horizon sometime after George Bush's term in office leaves. That's the key point here.
Mm-hmm. Well, and they'd have to withdraw from from the NPT and kick out the IAEA before they even started enriching to a high enough grade to make a bomb out of it, right?
Well, I think that's right. I mean, there is time, but I would say, you know, you need to be wary of these people, and Ahmadinejad is, I think, is a very, very dangerous figure, and certainly aspires to have this this kind of armament. I think also, you know, he's got no better friend in the world today than Dick Cheney, because, you know, his position within his own country was deteriorating very, very rapidly, and he needs this enemy from abroad in order to maintain his grasp on power. So, I think Ahmadinejad and Cheney are like, you know, babies separated at birth.
Yeah, peas in a pod, those two.
They feed off of one another.
Uh-huh. And now, so do you think that all this talk about a coup against Maliki and his replacement by Alawi is part of this, what Hirsch calls the redirection preparation for a move against Iran?
I'm not quite sure what to make about all of this. I heard beginning about 3 weeks ago down in Washington, I kept hearing from people that there's a lot of money flowing around all of a sudden, being spread out by, Alawi, and that he had engaged, Haley Barber's old, PR organization and a number of others. And I sort of dismissed that when I first heard it. And then I started looking at the newspapers. All of a sudden I see he's running an op-ed in the Washington Post. He's on CNN. He's on Fox. He's all over the place. And then I start hearing all these political figures standing up saying al-Maliki needs to go and isn't Alawi a wonderful person. I mean, and by the way, this is not just Republicans. I mean, this is all across the political spectrum. I mean, after all, we had Hillary Clinton and Carl Levin make these statements as well. And I think what we all need to be suspicious of is, you know, is this money being spread around in Washington, D.C. and talking? That would point to a real corruption of our democratic institutions. But I think aside from all of that, you know, there are real problems with al-Maliki. I mean, you know, he has a narrowly based government. His government's falling apart. And the biggest problem we've got in Iraq today, you know, it's not the U.S. military failing to fulfill its mission. I think, you know, the U.S. military does exactly what it's asked to do and does it very, very well. It's the political side of things. You know, their mission is to create an environment in which this government can consolidate power and strengthen itself. But instead, what's happening is we see a centrifuge going on. I mean, this government is falling apart and spinning apart. So it doesn't really make any difference what the U.S. forces are doing on the ground or what successes they achieve. The political objective is nowhere in sight.
Right. Well, and see, that's the whole thing, too, is you have this nonsense strategy, and you can have tactical things on the ground that actually do, quote-unquote, work, like, you know, al-Qaeda has overstayed their welcome and killed far too many civilians, and they finally get the local Sunni tribal militias and so forth fighting against them, and America takes all the credit for that and starts arming and financing them. But, of course, that doesn't help create a situation to bring them into the government. That only makes them stronger for resisting the domination of the Dawa Party and the Supreme Council, which they've been doing a great job of resisting all this time. So it's
I think
one
that's
step
right.
forward, two steps back.
Yeah, I think there have been important successes by the U.S. forces in Al-Anbar and Diyala province. But I think you have to also step back and look. Well, a lot of these successes are achieved by taking groups and units that we defined as the enemy and suddenly saying they're not the enemy and they're our friends and we'll support them. And of course, as soon as you do that and you change the label, then we've achieved a big success. You know, not to take away from them that there have been, I think there's been a big step forward, especially in Al-Anbar, in turning people against some of these foreign terrorist organizations. That also points to the complexity of the political problem you have in Iraq, where, you know, it's not the U.S. fighting against al-Qaeda, and that's the whole struggle. The situation is incredibly complex and difficult with dozens of different rival groups and bands that, you know, reconstitute and realign themselves on a weekly basis. It's an impossible situation to work with.
Now, about labeling the Iranian Revolutionary Guards terrorists, you're an international law expert. When I interviewed Ron Paul the Friday before last, I asked him if he was concerned that the administration had done this in order that they could try to use the authorization to use military force against Osama bin Laden and those who attacked us on 9/11 and to try to bring in the Iranian government under that umbrella of international terrorism. that Bush might actually be able to refer back to that original authorization to use force from September 2001 as his legal cover for starting another aggressive war, this time against Iran. And Ron Paul said he was concerned that that was exactly what they were trying to do there. Is that plausible to you, that they would try to use the original authorization to go after bin Laden in Afghanistan to bomb Iran?
I think there are a lot of people in Congress who are concerned about exactly that. In fact, there's been an initiative put forward to impose some limitations on the authorization for use of force to ensure that something like that doesn't happen. And I think, you know, this is a pretty complex situation. Let me just say, first of all, I have no doubt that the Revolutionary Guard had been involved in terrorist practices. That goes back a long time. I mean, the attack on the American Marines in Beirut, for instance, all sorts of terrible things that they've done in Lebanon and elsewhere. So they have a long track record of that. And, you know, on that point, of course, you know, it's a valid point. On the other hand, they're a part of the Iranian state. They report directly to the Iranian president. One of the tactical maneuvers that was available to the to the supreme leader, not to the president. And one of the maneuvers that was available to the government was bypassing Ahmadinejad and going and dealing with Khatami. And of course, by doing that, you foreclose that as a possibility. And also, when you label someone, when you label the armed forces of another state as terrorists, you're raising questions about whether you're going to abide by the laws of war, because the laws of war require that the armed forces of another state that you attack have to be treated in accordance with certain standards. And the U.S. has evaded that at several points in the past. So all this raises a lot of issues. I would just say, in the end, you know, in my mind, there's no doubt that we're dealing with real bad dudes in Iran, and that there's a grave threat in Iran. The question is, what's the most effective way of dealing with that threat? And, you know, I am far from convinced that these sorts of taunts and threats are the most effective way of dealing with them. We got to remember that in Iran proper, and, you know, in this entire region, you've only got one country where a very large part of the population likes the United States. That's Iran. That's a tremendous asset. We should be working with that asset to achieve the results we want in Iran. And you're never going to achieve that by launching an air war on them. What right. You'll do is unite that entire people around their loco leaders.
Yeah, well, and even the propaganda about, well, we are going to try to help the pro-American, pro-democracy forces in Iran, just marginalizes them and labels them as all dupes of the CIA and hurts them. It seems like the best way to help them is to ignore them completely.
Right, which resulted in a bunch of Americans being imprisoned there. You know, of course, that was also a bit of tit for tat for a bunch of Iranians who we seized and imprisoned in Iraq. So that sort of game's been going on in the back burner for a long time too, and you know that's something that Dick Cheney has been deeply involved in.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of labeling the Revolutionary Guards, the forces, I'm only asking you to speculate here, unless you have sources who told you or something. But do you think that this is why they labeled Iran's Revolutionary Guards a terrorist force, is so that they can use the authorization to use force against bin Laden and them as their legal cover? Is that the most obvious purpose for this?
I think that is a potential purpose. You know, I'm not convinced that it's the first purpose, but I think this step does make it easier for them to launch a war if they want to. And I think the other thing to really look at would be this use of a new generation of improvised explosive devices in Iraq. They've several times tried to trot out and make the case that all of this has to do with the Iranians, that they're behind it. They've supplied them. They're behind it. There is some evidence for this, but of course, you know, Iran is not the only foreign country that's involved in Iraq. You know, Saudi Arabia is involved. A lot of Saudi money backing terrorists there too, and we're not making threats about invading Saudi Arabia. So I think, you know, if we see them making that case, you know, that's going to be the casus belli that will be used. And then the new status given to the Revolutionary Guard will make it a lot easier for them to launch the attack.
Yep, I think that's exactly right. I think they've kind of given up on trying to claim that a nuclear weapon is imminent, and so they've kind of switched which lie they're going to use to justify the war, and You know, I just like to throw in here, it's been reported over and over and over again in Western media from Iraq that American soldiers have found EFP factories in Iraq. So the whole assertion basically comes down to, well, these bombs must be being made in Iran because the Iraqis surely couldn't be making them. But that's just not true. They've
and
been
more,
found
moreover,
over and over.
The number one supplier of arms to these terrorist organizations operating in Iraq is the United States. They've come from supply depots that we left unguarded.
That's right. That was you, wasn't it, that cited a military study that said that the majority of the American deaths and woundings and so forth are coming from American supplied weapons?
That's right, and then there's more being supplied from Saudi Arabia than Iran. So it's not. So I think you can't say that Iran isn't involved and isn't up to mischief. They are, but everybody is, frankly.
Now, you also talk about in your blog entry at harpers.org. Preparation for a dirty war. The branding of the Revolutionary Guard as terrorists raises troubling prospects. It would mean that they are denied the Geneva Convention. I guess that's what you just mentioned, right? That this would turn the laws of war from the laws of war between nation states to Geneva's quaint and doesn't apply.
That's exactly right. And, of course, you know, we didn't apply the Geneva Conventions properly to operations in Afghanistan. Then when we got to Iraq, we had mixed application. I would say there was general application going in initially, but very quickly after the occupation began, there were very serious lapses in application of the Geneva Conventions, which embarrassed us a lot. I mean, that's what led to Abu Ghraib, for instance, and a number of other things that happened there. And, you know, and that was a result of decisions that were taken in the White House, you know, not by the uniformed military who wanted to apply those Geneva rules. And, you know, the question is there a plan now to wage a war with Iran again, not applying the Geneva Conventions?
And we're already over time here, so last one really quickly here. You talk about the American military pushing contractors for unit costs. This seems to be implying ground operations, not just airstrikes.
Yeah, I've been told consistently that it's going to be an aerial war, but you can't do it without at least a minimal presence on the ground. You know, they have to be able to paint sites, guide missiles, do follow-up detection, and so forth. There's going to be some sort of presence on the ground, too, I think.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, there's a new story by Larissa Alexandrovna at Raw Story today about this British study that talked about absolute full-scale war against every part, every facet of the regime, their nuclear program, their military. And this number just did not sound right to me. 10,000 targets, that sounds like far, far more than we were talking about with Wayne White 6 months ago. So I don't know. I don't know exactly. But in that story, apparently these British scholars have come forward and are predicting a massive attack against Iran here.
We should all be concerned about it.
Well, we are, and thankfully we have you as a great source of information, always ahead of the curve. Scott Horton, contributing editor at Harper's Magazine. The blog is No Comment. Thanks very much for your time today, Scott. Appreciate it.
Take care.